Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 27, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Exciting news, my laminectomy, which is the minimally invasive procedure that I'm going to have with Dr. Lantner, has been approved by insurance. So it looks like it will happen. The next jump, the next hoop I have to jump through is the pre-op physical. And I'll be doing that in a couple of weeks. And as long as that goes okay, I'm good to go. So it's going to be a short procedure. I will go to a surgical center, not into the hospital. However, the surgical center is across the street from the hospital. And I will only be there for a couple of hours. The procedure itself is, if they only do one spinal level, it's an hour. And if they do two, it's going to be an hour and 10. So I'll have to be under and then brought out of being under. So I don't know if that amount of time includes the time to get me into anesthesia or not. You know, the whole procedure is maybe a couple of hours. I'll be in the center for maybe 2.5 hours, and then they kick me out and I go home. And then I have to recover. And my understanding is the recovery isn't terrible. It's not going to be nearly as painful as what Ron experienced. They will send me home with pain medication, which includes opioids. I'm hoping not to take the opioids. I don't know what I will take. If I need pain medication, I'll take acetaminophen because I do well with acetaminophen. And as soon as they allow me to take supplements, I'll start my supplements back up. Because magnesium and curcumin and bromelain and other proteolytic enzymes, natokinase, can all help to reduce inflammation and reduce pain. So even though I have the spinal stenosis in my leg, I have the pain in my leg, it's not as bad as it could be if I didn't take all the things that I take. So one of the things that happens is when you have surgery, if you're taking nutritional supplements, the concern is that you need to stop your supplements. Dr. Lantner wants me to stop 2 weeks before the surgery. And that's because a lot of healthy supplements and also foods, healthy foods, have antiplatelet aggregating activity. Foods that are anti-inflammatory have antiplatelet aggregating activity. What does that even mean? So platelets are the white blood cells that you have that stick together. They are drawn to places where you have cuts, where you have breaches, breaks, and certainly they're drawn to, if you're cut into, if you have any surgical incisions, that's your body doesn't care that it's a surgical incision. It thinks it's an injury. So, your platelets are going to go there to try to patch it up. If the platelets don't stick together well, you can't clot as easily. On the other hand, having a lot of foods on board as a general practice that inhibit platelet aggregating is a good idea because you're less likely to make a blood clot in your body that can then give you cardiovascular, that can give you an embolism, that can block your coronary arteries, the arteries that feed oxygen and nutrition to the muscle of your heart. And you're less likely to get, when you're still and you have blood pooling, like when you're on an airplane, you can get a blood clot in your leg because you're not moving around a lot. And so if you eat an anti-inflammatory diet, that's less likely to happen. Why? Because things like fruits and vegetables, leafy greens, nuts and seeds, essential fatty acids, fish, all those things have properties of antiplatelet aggregating. So am I going to stop eating those foods? No. But I will probably stop taking a lot of my supplements. I may wind up taking like one magnesium a day. I will probably stop fish oil and ask Ron to feed me a lot of fish. I'll eat extra herring and things like that. And I still will eat my salads, all my healthy food, because those nutrients are going to help me to heal quicker on the other hand. So if you eat foods that are high in zinc is important for healing. And I have to look and see if zinc has antiplatelet aggregating activity, because I might not be able to take the zinc either. So I'm going to take very low amounts of stuff. I will probably continue to take motherwort, because motherwort helps to keep my heart in shape. I might take a tiny bit of hawthorn, I don't know, but motherwort I'm probably going to take. And I will continue to take my probiotics as well. So I have to go through all my supplements and figure out which are antiplatelet aggregating. Hint, if you're not sure, if you're having surgery and your doctor says to you, I want you to stop your supplements 1 week, 5 days, 2 weeks, whatever, before your procedure, then it's okay to just stop them all. If there's something that really, really helps you and you're afraid to stop it, then talk it over with your doctor. But most of the supplements, you know, I'm a little concerned because, you know, I take a lot of supplements to help keep me in line. One of the things that I have done is because I'm concerned about my blood pressure and it's very difficult for me to raise my blood pressure medicine dose. I have lisinopril and I've tried to raise it from 5 to 7.5 milligrams. And if I do that, I'm very sleepy and tired and lightheaded and I have episodes where I feel like I'm going to pass out. At 5 milligrams, that doesn't happen. So I can't seem to raise it. So my mother said to me that she stopped eating sugar. She stopped eating all added sugars. So she's not eating sweets, candies, pastries, cookies, anything like that, ice cream. She's avoiding all of those things, not adding sugar to her coffee or tea. I don't think she's having caffeine either. So she's not doing caffeine, sugar, gluten, dairy. So I'm doing that as well. And I started doing that a few days ago. And my blood pressure is gradually starting to come down because the 5 milligrams of lisinopril is not adequate to keep my blood pressure low. But if I go on a very anti-inflammatory diet, it may be. So because it is starting to come down. And so by the time I have my my pre-op physical, which is a week from and a half from now, I should have much lower blood pressure. And then the surgery is 2.5 weeks after the pre-op physical. So all that time, no sugar, no caffeine, no dairy, no gluten, as little flour as possible. I might eat wraps. I might eat like small amounts of gluten-free wraps and have a sandwich on. But I won't do that every day. I'm mostly having, I'm having fish and seaweed salad and beans for lunch, and I'm having non-dairy yogurt with fruit and chia seeds for breakfast with a little bit of very low sugar muesli on top, and I'm having mostly salad and protein for dinner or stir fry and protein. I'm finding that, you know, when you go cold turkey off sugar, it's not easy. Like the first few days you feel a little lightheaded and starving. I was talking with Ryan, who is the husband of Nicole, my acupuncturist, and he practices nutrition, and they're mostly vegan. And there is a movement in some plant-based diets that you shouldn't consume extruded oils. So you shouldn't have fish oil, you shouldn't have olive oil, you should just eat the food that has the oil in it. And Campbell and Esselstyn, who are very, they wrote books on eating the China study. And they talk about not eating extruded oils because they think the extruded oils decay and they're inflammatory. So he suggested to me last night, maybe don't have oil and vinegar on your salad, have just the vinegar, or instead of putting vinegar on your salad, why not put fermented vegetables on your salad? So I thought that was an interesting idea. I went to do it last night and then I didn't do it. But I might tonight. We'll see. If I have salad tonight. I took out the non-pasteurized sauerkraut and I went to put it on my salad and then I didn't do it. And I also have some fermented carrots with ginger in them in the house, and maybe I'll add those tonight. I like the fermented carrots with ginger in them. They're very good, but they do smell a little bit like feet. And the thing is, when you get fermented vegetables, sometimes they do have that sort of, I don't know if it's lactic acid that smells like that, or they have this funky smell that's characteristic of fermented stuff. And I'm not always crazy about it, but sauerkraut I love. I love to eat sauerkraut. We get healthy hot dogs. We don't buy like commercial hot dogs. We get like grass-fed beef hot dogs, or we get turkey dogs made from a healthful company. And I love to put sauerkraut on my hot dogs. So So sauerkraut is something I really enjoy. Not everybody likes sauerkraut, but I like it's vinegary and it's fermented, and I like the texture. And so, and eating fermented foods is really good for you because it gets your probiotics on board. And, you know, having fermented foods on board is a good thing. So anyway, so for those couple of weeks before the surgery, I'm going to have to not take supplements. I'm going to have to eat a really clean diet and stay away from refined sugar and caffeine. Alcohol, of course, that's not a big deal for me because I drink so little anyway, but I won't be drinking any alcohol. And then I have to find out when after the surgery I can start taking my supplements again. And then after the surgery, I might have treats now and again. But right now, it's no sugar, no dairy, no gluten, virtually no flour, and no added sugars at all. So what am I eating? Like I said, I'm eating non-dairy yogurt, I'm eating fruit, I'm eating nuts and seeds, I'm eating chia seeds, I'm eating high-quality tuna fish, and I put mayonnaise in it, and the mayonnaise I use has avocado oil and not canola oil. And I am having herring and wine sauce, and I'm having seaweed salad, I'm eating some seaweed. I will probably eat some kimchi, I'm eating beans. I haven't had quinoa in the last few days, but I probably will. And because I was feeling sort of lightheaded and that difficulty you have, because the first few days when you're on a sugar detox, you can feel a little off. And I was talking to Ryan last night and, I said, I feel like I'm eating a little bit too low carb. And he said, well, you can eat some carbs. And I said, well, maybe I should go get some sweet potato and plantain and green plantain. And he said, I don't think that's, and he said, why are you on the sugar detox? I said, because I want to lower my blood pressure. And he said, well, I think if you eat sweet potato and green plantain, that's not going to raise your blood pressure. That might help lower your blood pressure. So I'm going to go grab some sweet potato and green plantain and have those. And I'll roast the sweet potato. I'll saute the green plantain and season it. And I'll have that along with my supper. And I might also make some quinoa and have that along. So I need to increase my carbs, because if I go too low carb, I'm still riding my bike. And if you ride your bike, and I did a really intense ride today. I rode only 25 miles, but I rode into Hampton, and Hampton sits on top of a hill. So I looked at my stats. I live in Mansfield Center, and the spot that I live in Mansfield Center is at just over 300 feet. And in order to get to Hampton, I have to go up and down. So I do some descending, but I do mostly climbing. And so I have to climb at least 400 feet. And you don't do it all at once. It's up and down. It's not like it's a straight shot up to Hampton unless you take the rail trail, which I did not do. I did a road ride. And any direction you come to Hampton, you're going to climb. And my highest point in Hampton was 737 feet. Whereas my house is at 300 feet. The boat launch at Bassett's Bridge Road, on Bassett's Bridge Road, is about 130 feet. And then Mansfield Center, 195, sits at just over 200 feet. And then Storrs sits at 600 or 700 feet as well. So if you want to do hill training, you're going to go up and down. And so there's this app called Strava that helps you to tally your rides and tells you about your fitness. And so I use a bike computer, a Wahoo, that records my ride, and then it imports it into Strava. And Strava gives you feedback, gives you everything is AI now. So Strava gives you AI feedback on your ride. And Strava said, wow, that you did an epic hill climb today. It was very funny. I didn't ask it to say that, and that's what it said, because it was 1,600 feet in only 25 miles. So it was a lot of climbing today. It took me a long time to do. And now my leg is a little sore. So the next couple of days, I'm going to go shorter and flatter and make sure I do I haven't done my PT exercises yet today, but I find that if I do the PT exercises, I'm in minimal pain right now, which is really great. I still do have, right now I can feel that I have that numbness on the lateral left side of my leg, but I'm looking forward to getting the surgery, even though I'm going to have some downtime after the surgery. So with the date that we've set it up, I'm off the following week, so I'll have a lot of time to do recovery. So that's good. So that's what's going on. Ron went off to Pennsylvania to do a farm to fork fondo, so I guess he's doing okay. He drove all the way to Amish country, so that's exciting. So I'm here making a show while he's away, and and he'll make a show either, you know, in a couple of days when he gets back. So I get to do things like watch TV shows that he doesn't like. Like, I like to watch In Just Like That, which is the reboot of Sex and the City. So I'm catching up on that. And there's a couple other things I like to watch that he doesn't care to watch. So I have some other things to look at. So I have some more things to talk about. So we want to talk about, first thing I want to talk about is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I had a patient grilling me. She really wanted to know she had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, but she didn't have thyroid antibodies. So I said, I don't think you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, but she wanted to know if she developed it. So we have to recheck her antibodies. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about Hashimoto's thyroiditis because I haven't talked about it in a long time. So it's an autoimmune disorder that causes your body cells to attack your thyroid gland. You make antibodies that attack the thyroid gland, and what you measure is thyroid peroxidase and thyroglobulin antibodies. And if those are elevated, you may have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. You can have other things too. You can have Graves' disease, and God forbid, you can have thyroid cancer. So I screen everybody unless they tell me not to, or unless they've already been screened, or if they don't have insurance that allows me to order them labs. But I screen all my patients for Hashimoto's because I have caught people's thyroid cancer that way. If you have an elevated thyroid globulin, as soon as I see thyroid antibodies, I recommend to the patient you need to have a thyroid ultrasound. So you diagnose Hashimoto's in part when you see elevated thyroid peroxidase and maybe thyroid globulin antibodies, and then you look at the thyroid. The thyroid will have a characteristic appearance, and what it will look like is there may be increased vascularity. There's more blood vessels because there's inflammation going on, so the body's trying to deal with the inflammation. There could be lesions on the thyroid gland. There are lumps and bumps. And what you'll see is it'll report heterogeneous texture. If any of the bumps on your thyroid are greater than 1 centimeter, either the radiologist is going to recommend watching them at a shorter duration, or they're going to recommend fine needle aspiration, which means biopsy. So, as I said, if you have elevated thyroid antibodies, it can indicate thyroid cancer. So if you have thyroid antibodies, it's a good idea to get a thyroid ultrasound. I always offer it to my patients. Patients don't always want to do it. I've had patients say to me when they have positive thyroid antibodies, I've had them say, I don't have cancer, I'm fine. And I'm like, how do you know? You don't know. You have to have an ultrasound. But some people decline the ultrasound and they want me to treat them for the thyroid antibodies. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? I mean, I can treat you for inflammation. We can just sort of assume that you don't have cancer. But I'm very concerned about you. So I've had a couple of people do that they're sure they don't have cancer and they won't take the thyroid ultrasound, even though an elevated thyroglobulin, when you're diagnosed with thyroid cancer, the way they measure whether it's returned or metastasized after you have surgery is by measuring your thyroglobulin antibody. So when I saw a colleague, an endocrinologist, using thyroglobulin as a measure of whether the thyroid cancer had come back or metastasized, I said, I should be screening everybody for this. It's a simple thing to do. And I have caught people's Hashimoto's. I haven't caught Graves' disease because usually Hashimoto's can be low grade and subtle. You can have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. You can have inflamed thyroid and be what's called euthyroid, meaning you don't have an enlarged thyroid. And that happens sometimes. But if you have Graves' disease, if you have thyroiditis where you have hyperthyroidism, you're going to know it because you're not going to feel well. You're not going to be able to sleep. You're going to sweat. You're going to lose weight. You're going to have palpitations. You have a lot of symptoms. And so depending on what's going on there, you have to treat that appropriately. But if somebody comes in and they're, you know, they can't sleep and they're And obviously, so the other thing that happens is you can have a goiter. And the word goiter simply means your thyroid's enlarged. You don't know why, but it's enlarged. You have to investigate further to find out why it's enlarged. And if somebody has a goiter, whether or not they have thyroid antibodies or not, you want to do an ultrasound. I had a patient not too long ago who had a very large mass, and we did a thyroid ultrasound on him, or he had thyroid ultrasounds. I don't know if I did it. He might have had one already, and then I repeated it. And we looked at it, and he had a large mass, and he had absolutely no antibodies and a normal functioning thyroid. So it was just a benign mass, but it was space occupying. So if you have a mass that's space occupying, if it's getting in the way of stuff, like if you're uncomfortable having it there, or you have trouble swallowing, it's pressing on a structure, or you have pain, that would be a reason to take it out. So he's thinking about it. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit more about Hashimoto's. It's known as Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Hashimoto's disease, and it can reduce your thyroid function. It's also called chronic autoimmune lymphocytic thyroiditis. In the U.S., Hashimoto's is the most common cause of hypothyroidism. So your thyroid releases hormones that regulate your metabolism, body temperature, muscle strength, and other functions of the body. It's an autoimmune disorder. It causes white blood cells and antibodies to mistakenly attack the cells of the thyroid. And it's not really known why it's happened, but there's probably some genetics involved because we see hypothyroidism and thyroiditis run in families. So if you have Hashimoto's, it's sometimes more likely to occur in women than men, especially women who have been pregnant. Your risk can be higher if you have a family history of autoimmune diseases such as Graves' disease, which is autoimmune hyperthyroidism, type 1 diabetes, lupus, so other autoimmune conditions, lupus, Sjogren's syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, Addison's disease, and vitiligo. Vitiligo is where you have antibodies that are attacking your melanocytes, the cells that make pigment in your skin. And Addison's disease is where you have basically adrenal failure. Your adrenals are not kicking out your cortisol and your all of your adrenal hormones. So you wind up having to take cortisone externally. Like when you're hypothyroid, you take thyroid hormone. And when you have Addison's disease, you take cortisone as a medicine, as a replacement medicine. So what can be the symptoms of Hashimoto's? Well, it can look like a lot of other things. It causes the symptoms of underactive thyroid, usually. Signs that your thyroid isn't working properly can include dry, pale skin, constipation, a hoarse voice because your thyroid's enlarged, so it's pressing on your larynx, your voice box. You can have high cholesterol. The thyroid, when you're hypothyroid, your cholesterol can go up. Thyroid helps to increase your metabolism, helps you to burn fat. And so if you have an underfunctioning thyroid, your cholesterol can go up. You can have depression because you have low energy and your body can interpret that as depression. It slows your brain functioning. So you can have lower body muscle weakness. I would think whole body muscle weakness, but lower body is going to be more likely because it takes more energy to move the lower body. You can be tired and sluggish. You can have cold intolerance. Your hair can thin. And you can have irregular or heavy periods if you're female, and you can have problems with fertility. You can have Hashimoto's for many years before you experience any symptoms. It can progress for a long time before it causes noticeable thyroid damage. So if I see that somebody has Hashimoto's, and then we do a thyroid ultrasound, and so they have elevated antibodies, and they have an ultrasound, and the ultrasound doesn't show anything concerning, I will encourage them to do things to reduce inflammation. One of the big things is to avoid gluten because when you eat more gluten, you have more thyroid peroxidase antibodies. There is an interaction between gliadin antibodies and thyroid peroxidase antibodies. If you eat more gluten, you will have more thyroid peroxidase antibodies. And I have seen many people with elevated thyroid peroxidase antibodies stop gluten and watch their thyroid antibodies come down over time. So some people with the condition will have a goiter, an enlarged thyroid. It can cause the front of your neck to be swollen, and it rarely causes pain, but it could be tender when it's touched, and it can also interfere with your swallowing or cause your throat to feel full. Your doctor may suspect the condition if you have the symptoms of an underactive thyroid, so they'll check. We'll check the TSH levels with a blood test. I check TSH, I check free T4, I check free T3, and I check thyroid antibodies. And your TSH is thyroid-stimulating hormone, and thyroid-stimulating hormone is made, it's not made by your thyroid, it's made by the pituitary gland, which is the master gland of the endocrine system. And thyroid-stimulating hormone stimulates the thyroid gland to make thyroid hormone. And so when your thyroid is under-functioning, your pituitary will notice and it will kick up the amount of TSH it's making. So when you're a hyperthyroid, your TSH, hypothyroid, your TSH levels will go up. So your doctor may also use blood tests to check levels of other thyroid hormones, which is what I do, and the antibodies and your cholesterol. And they can help confirm the diagnosis. As I said, I think the ultrasound also helps to confirm the diagnosis. But if you have an absolutely normal ultrasound and you have the antibodies, you have to treat the antibodies, in my opinion, because it's a sign that you have inflammation. And if you let them go over time, you can have damage and destruction of thyroid tissue. So most people with Hashimoto's need treatment, but if your thyroid is functioning normally, your doctor may just monitor you for changes. So if you have a normally functioning thyroid, there's no reason to take thyroid medicine. Unless you are symptomatic, if you're tired and sluggish and you have some of the symptoms that we just mentioned, you might be given thyroid medicine. I wouldn't do that. I only recommend thyroid medicine, whether it's natural medicine or get you to somewhere where you can get prescribed, if somebody's actually symptomatic and or they have an elevated TSH and perhaps low T3 and T4. So if your thyroid isn't producing enough hormones, you need medication, and you're often given levothyroxine. So levothyroxine is a synthetic hormone that replaces T4, and it's bioidentical. So a lot of people say, I don't want to take levothyroxine. So if their TSH isn't too high, so say their TSH is 4 or 5, I will give them glandulars. I'll give them supplements that have thyroid tissue from animals in it to help to regenerate their thyroid, or I might give them supplements that have things like kelp, which has iodine in it, things like ashwagandha and curcumin and coleus. These are all herbs that can help the thyroid gland to function more normally. And also, you want to look at the T4. You want to look at the T3 as well. If the T3 is low but the T4 is normal and the TSH is normal, they may have a conversion problem. They have trouble converting T4 to T3. And in fact, thyroid peroxidase helps T4 to be converted to T3. So I will sometimes give nutrients or supplements that help convert T4 to T3. And zinc and selenium are two minerals that are needed to help you convert T4 to T3. So we give supplements that have that and also some iodine and usually tyrosine as well, because tyrosine is an amino acid. It's one of the essential amino acids, which means that you have to eat it. And tyrosine it gets converted to thyroid hormone. So a lot of supplements that help you to have a better functioning thyroid will include tyrosine in it. If you're taking levothyroxine, I would generally, I don't always give people supplements when they have it unless I know they have a low T3, and then I'll give something to help them convert the T4 to T3. And so it's an individual approach. It depends on what's going on, but I will tell you that if you have elevated thyroid antibodies, bottoms up, I'm drinking my water. Elevated thyroid antibodies, I'm going to tell you to stop eating gluten, because I have seen over and over people lower their thyroid peroxidase antibodies by avoiding gluten, or when they avoid gluten. So some supplements and medications can affect your abilities, your body's ability to absorb levothyroxine. So it's important to talk to your doctor about other things you're taking. And so iron supplements can interfere with thyroid absorption. So if you're taking iron, if you're taking iron or calcium, iron and calcium can interfere with absorption of thyroid hormone. So take it at a different time of day. One of the things I try to tell people to do is if you get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, that's when to take your thyroid hormone. It will not wake you up, but your stomach tends to be empty at that time and you're many hours away from eating anything. So people are often told, take your thyroid medicine on an empty stomach and wait a half an hour to an hour before you eat. I don't think that's enough time. That's why I think people should take their thyroid medicine in the middle of the night. And Ron is hypothyroid. He doesn't have Hashimoto's, but he's hypothyroid. So he has to take levothyroxine. And I have instructed him to take it in the middle of the night, which he does. So he wakes up in the middle of the night and to go to the bathroom. And that's when he takes his levothyroxine. So it was wild. A few years ago, I was shocked because Ron is very slender. If you've ever met him or seen him on his Bicycle Talk show broadcasting, you can see that he's very slender. But a few years ago, he had his thyroid checked and his TSH was 14. It was super high. I'm like, Ron, you're walking around, you're hypothyroid. I can't believe it. So since then, he's been taking thyroid medication. It wasn't even like it was 4 or 5 or 6. It was 14. I've seen much higher than that. People come in and they're not taking their thyroid medication. Their TSH is 87. I've seen it. And I've seen people with thyroid peroxidase antibodies where they're off the chart. Literally, off the chart means that there's a reference range. And the reference range for Quest Diagnostics is 900 for thyroid peroxidase antibodies. And some people will come in and they're above the reference range. The labs come back and it says over 900. So anyway, so iron and calcium supplements can interfere with absorption. If you take proton pump inhibitors, that can interfere with thyroid medicine absorption. So apparently you need stomach acid to help absorb the thyroid medicine. So if you take a proton pump inhibitor, again, hours and hours apart. So if you take it in the middle of the night and you take your proton pump inhibitor in the morning. So proton pump inhibitors are those acid blocking drugs that end in prazole. So lansoprazole, omeprazole, esomeprazole, pantoprazole, all those prazoles. Those are acid blocking drugs that are proton pumps. They're very strong drugs, and you want to take them many hours away. So take your thyroid medicine in the middle of the night and take your proton pump inhibitor when you wake up in the morning. Some cholesterol meds can interfere with thyroid absorption. It doesn't say which one, so I don't know if it's statins or your PCSK9 inhibitors, but they can interfere with absorption of thyroid medicine. And then, of course, estrogen and also intense phytoestrogens. I had a patient many years ago who would take her thyroid medicine at the same time she would eat breakfast. And when she ate breakfast, she'd have soy milk in her cereal, or she'd have a glass of soy milk. Anyway, she was consuming soy milk at the same time. Soy milk has isoflavones in it, which are phytoestrogens, and that can be very helpful if you're peri or postmenopausal, or if you need an estrogen boost that you don't have some kind of estrogen hypofunction. I like to offer soy with active isoflavones to peri and postmenopausal women. Women who are younger generally don't need it because they have plenty of estrogen on board. But if you take estrogen supplements, or if you consume soy products that are high in isoflavones at the same time as your thyroid medicine, it can block you from absorbing your thyroid medicine. And this patient that came in, that happened to her. And I said, you got to stop that. You can have your soy milk, but take your thyroid medicine in the middle of the night. And she did, and she felt so much better. She had so much more energy. It worked. If you have an estrogen patch, it's possible. The nice thing about having a patch or having a topical sort of estrogen is that it avoids the first liver pass. So the dose of estrogen that you're getting in your body compared to what you would get if you're taking a pill is much lower. So you might be okay with that. But the thing is, if you have a patch, it's releasing hormone all the time. So you can't really get away from you still should take it in the middle of the night because you want to keep it away from any foods that you're eating and any potential foods that are going to block you from absorbing your thyroid hormone. But you can't do anything about the estrogen. If you're taking estrogen, you're taking estrogen. And so you have to work around that. So this says it right here, like I was saying, you might have to adjust the time of day you take your thyroid medicine when you take other medicines, and certain foods may also affect. Oh, so when we say soy, we're talking things that have a lot of isoflavones in it. So that's going to be tempeh, tofu, edamame, toasted edamame, and soy milk. Not so much soy sauce. And tofu, if you're only having a little bit of tofu, it's not a big deal. And if you're in the habit of eating a lot of soy, it's a big deal, but you don't have to never eat soy. So, like, if you take your thyroid medicine in the middle of the night, so you wake up 4 a.m. to go to the bathroom, you take your thyroid medicine, and then that night you're having a salad and you want to put some toasted edamame in it, it's fine. Or if you're going to have, you know, tempeh or tofu with your dinner, it's fine. Just so long as you're not, soy isn't a staple food for you. If you have a soy latte once every couple of weeks, that's not a big deal. If you have tofu or tempeh in your food, or you occasionally have edamame in your salad, that's that. If it's occasional, it's not every day, then it's fine. But if you have soy a lot, that is probably not a good idea. It's probably not a good idea. You're going to block the phytoestrogens in soy, the isoflavones, could potentially block you from absorbing your thyroid hormone. So, complications of Hashimoto's. If it's not treated, it can cause complications. You can get heart problems, including heart failure. My goodness. You can become anemic. You can get confused and even lose consciousness. I've never seen any of these. I mean, even people who come in and their antibodies are through the roof, they just don't feel so good. They're not at this point. So this can happen, but I think these are extreme cases. But I honestly have not seen them. You can have high cholesterol, you can have decreased sex drive, and you can be depressed. That I see a lot more in general for all kinds of reasons, not just from hypothyroidism. To limit the complications, you want to monitor your thyroid function over the course of pregnancy in women who have thyroid problems. For women with no known thyroid disorders, so routine thyroid screening isn't recommended during pregnancy. So that's interesting. So that's Hashimoto's. And so how I treat Hashimoto's is individual. It depends on the person who's coming in, depends what's going on. If you come in and you have Hashimoto's, that of course is not the only thing I'm going to look at. I'm going to look at you as a whole person. But as I said, when somebody comes in, I screen people in general for thyroid antibodies, thyroid peroxidase, and thyroglobulin antibodies. I screen them for TSH, T3, and T4. If they have a doc that's already doing that, then I will get those records and look at them. And then I monitor them, and then I will treat them based on what's going on. If somebody has low T3 and they have normal TSH and T4, whether they're taking medicine or not, I might give them something to help convert their T4 to T3. And sometimes people are actually given T3 to take if they're not good at converting T4 to T3. If somebody's already comes in and they're on levothyroxine and leothyronine, which is synthetic T3, then I'm not going to give them the conversion stuff because they're just taking it. And then, you know, it's an autoimmune inflammatory condition, so we're going to talk to you about reducing inflammation. So if you're eating junk, if you're eating a lot of sugar, if you're drinking too much alcohol, if you're eating poor quality fats, we're going to talk to you about that. We're going to talk to you about eating an anti-inflammatory diet. A lot of plants. You don't have to be completely plant-based. I consider that I eat mostly a plant-based diet with some animal protein in it, but I eat a lot of plants. So I eat a lot of plant-based stuff. And so we're going to encourage you to do that. You know, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean protein, whole grains, things like brown rice and quinoa, amaranth, oats, and, you know, we said nuts and seeds and legumes if you tolerate them, and clean animal protein if you are not a vegetarian. Dairy if you tolerate it, although gluten, I don't recommend gluten if you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, because gluten can raise your thyroid peroxidase antibodies, and in fact, if you stop eating gluten, I have seen people's thyroid peroxidase antibodies go down dramatically, which is going to help their thyroid function. So there you go. All right. Here's an interesting article about changing your foot angle when walking. It can help slow the progression of knee osteoarthritis. So I pulled this because I have knee osteoarthritis. So I should be listening to my grandmother, may she rest in peace, God rest her soul, my grandma Minnie Rothbaum. She also, you always used to criticize me, and I'm like, you know, get off my case, jeez. But she would criticize me because I have femoral antiversion and genuvalgus. So femoral antiversion means that my hips turn inward, and my knees also turn inward. So I walk kind of pigeon-toed. So my feet kind of turn in. So she was always trying to get me to turn my feet out when I walked. Well, it looks like Grandma Minnie may have had a point. So this is interesting. A small change in how you walk may help relieve osteoarthritis pain. And I do have it. I have osteoarthritis bilaterally in my knees. I have bone on bone, my femurs to my patella in both knees. And I was told by a doctor that right now all I have to do is get my knees really strong. And riding a bike is fine. I can do some exercises to strengthen my knees, and that's fine. And if I get to a point where I need help, then they want to replace my patellas. So I think that before I would do that, I would sort of research some other options. Is there something I can have injected into my knees that I would consider getting PRP, platelet-rich plasma, which is something that they take your blood and they spin down for the platelets, and then they re-inject it into your knees, which can help with healing. So I would consider doing that, and some synthetic gels I might consider getting. So, but I'm not there right now. My knees are not bad enough to be concerned about right now. I'm basically able to exercise except for the spinal stenosis and the pain in my leg, and I wear knee sleeves. So I wear these lovely knee sleeves that have bamboo in them, and they are really helpful, and they have just the right amount of compression, and they make it so I can climb 1,600 feet in 25 miles and be okay. My knees are pretty much okay. And then, so whenever I'm exercising, if I'm going for a walk out, like I don't wear them every day, and I don't wear them to bed, but if I'm doing any kind of exercise, whether I'm walking, doing resistance training, doing my PT exercises, doing yoga, or on my bike, I wear the knee sleeves. So, and I also might put it on, like if I was going to go do a lot of walking, like if I was going to go to a city and walk around the city, I would probably put them on. Or if I was going to be shopping for a day and doing a lot of walking, I would probably put on a sleeve. So osteoarthritis is a chronic degenerative condition of your joints that commonly occurs in people over 40. I'm over 60, so here we go. It can affect any joint in your body, most commonly your knees, hands, hips, and there's no cure, but the condition can be managed by staying physically active, maintaining a healthy weight, and taking medications to relieve pain. And you can also take things to help, to rebuild cartilage, things like collagen and glucosamine. And you can take supplements like curcumin and boswellia and rosemary, which reduce inflammation, and fish oil as well, which help you rebuild cells all over your body and are anti-inflammatory. There's a study that's found that modifying your walking style may relieve the pain and slow the progression of knee osteoarthritis as effectively as commonly used medications. So that's great. And commonly used medications, that's going to be your acetaminophen and your NSAIDs, like your naproxen and your ibuprofen. So I can't take NSAIDs, and they make me sick. No matter, I tried to take, my pain in my leg was really bad, I tried to take a naproxen, and I couldn't do it. It bothered my stomach. So all the NSAIDs, out. I can't do ibuprofen, I can't do naproxen. I wouldn't take aspirin regularly because aspirin makes you bleed. Ron turned out to be anemic, and we think it's because he was taking aspirin. I was very worried before he had a surgery. His CBC showed that he was anemic, and then we realized it was probably the aspirin that was doing it, because he told me that when he shaves, it takes him a long time to heal the cuts. And I'm like, well, that's the aspirin doing it. And he was taking 81 milligrams of baby aspirin, right? And so my mother started taking aspirin, and she was taking 500 milligrams a day. And then she showed me on her, I was doing a video chat with her, and she had all these bruises. I'm like, Ma, stop taking the aspirin. It's the aspirin that's doing that. You know, and when you get older, you have thinner skin, and you have your capillaries are more fragile, and she's taking this aspirin. I'm like, no. All right. So as we said, osteoarthritis can affect any joint in the body. It's most common in your knees, which can cause pain and problems with walking and exercise. And treatments can alleviate symptoms, but don't cure it. So several ways to help delay the onset is to keep physically active, maintain a healthy weight, protect your joints from injury, over-the-counter prescription medicines, or using crutches or a walking stick if needed. I'm not needing to do that at this point. A new study from researchers at the University of Utah, also at NYU and Stanford, suggests that learning to walk differently could both slow the progression and relieve the pain of knee osteoarthritis. The study was published in The Lancet Rheumatology and found that changing the angle of the foot while walking could be as effective as commonly used medications. Boy, so simple. You just have to do it. So David Cruz, who's a primary care sports medicine physician at Cedars-Sinai Orthopedics in LA, who was not involved in the research, commented that the result of the study by Ulrich et al. Examined the effect of gait retraining on knee osteoarthritis outcomes, and it's encouraging. They successfully showed positive outcomes through a personal intervention that optimized joint unloading. Additionally, identifying an intervention that not only improves management but also helps to slow progression of osteoarthritis is very promising. The improvement in pain is significant. So Valentina Mazzoli, who's assistant professor in the Department of Radiology at NYU Grossman School of Medicine and co-lead author of the study, explained in the research that showed that shifting the angle of the feet while walking can reduce knee pain and osteoarthritis. The improvement in pain is significant and of the same magnitude of what is typically achieved with pain medication without any of the pharmacological side effects, which makes gait retraining a very promising and effective option for early stage osteoarthritis. The participants in the study were 18 or over. They had early stage medial compartment knee osteoarthritis, graded 1 to 3 on the Kellgren-Lawrence scale, where 4 is severe by a radiologist. 68 people in the study could walk unaided for 25 minutes on a treadmill, had a body mass index of less than 35 kilograms per meter squared. So 35, so that 30 to 35 is medium risk obesity. And no, that's not right. 30 to 35 is low risk obesity. 35 to 39 is medium risk, and then over 40 is high-risk obesity. And then 25 to 29 is overweight. So these folks had all of them were no more than low-risk obese. And they reported medial knee pain of 3 or more on 11-point scale. So small adjustments reduced pain and joint degeneration. And so all participants underwent MRI scans, had their gait analyzed in the laboratory before being randomly assigned in a 1-to-1 ratio to the intervention group or the control group. Researchers told them they were involved in a 2-group study investigating which type of personalized foot progression angle walking training was most effective to ensure they didn't know which group they were in. During the first 6 weeks, participants visited the gait laboratory once a week. The intervention group were trained to change their foot progression, which is angle, toe in or toe out by 5 to 10 degrees to reduce the load in the knees. So the load on the knees. So that means that somebody like me, where I tend to walk pigeon-toed, where I tend to angle my feet in when I walk, I would be instructed to turn my feet out just 5 to 10 degrees. And if I would pay attention and do that, it's just like what Grandma said when I was a kid. She was right. Grandma was right. What can I do? And so if somebody tends to walk with their feet splayed, turned out, and they have knee osteoarthritis, then if they turn it in a little bit, that doesn't mean they have to walk pigeon-toed, but if they tend to have turnout, they are going to turn it in 5 or 10 degrees, which isn't much at all, and that's going to help them. So I wanted to know, is it always turning out or turning in? I think it depends on the person. That's what I'm understanding from reading this. The sham group underwent the same training, but their natural angle of foot progression was unchanged. After the 6 training sessions, they were encouraged to practice their walking technique for at least 20 minutes a day until it became natural. During the 1-year follow-up, they attended the laboratory 3 times so researchers could check that they were maintaining the prescribed angle. At the end of the study, the intervention group reported a larger reduction in pain than the control group, with the intervention group pain score reducing on average by 2.5 and the controls by 1.3 from the beginning of the study. So everybody was walking at least 20 minutes a day. So walking 20 minutes a day helped everybody to have less osteoarthritis. So you get that because the control group improved by 1.3 rating. So it was only, 1.2 more points with the intervention. So one of the things that this study shows is, yes, if you change your knee angle by 5 to 10 degrees, you're going to have less osteoarthritis pain. The other thing it shows is that if you walk for 20 minutes a day, you're going to have less osteoarthritis pain. Although you're less likely to have less osteoarthritis pain if you don't do the change in the angle of your foot. But so if you want to have less joint pain, go for a walk. That's what this is suggesting. Or get exercise, move. MRI scans show that the intervention group had less degeneration of their knee cartilage than the control group. So this is an exciting finding in this study, that there's a potential slowing of cartilage degeneration with gait retraining, and it holds substantial potential. Further study is still needed to understand whether or not the amount of time, the amount of demonstrated slowing will translate to improved clinical outcomes over time. So, can it be an effective alternative to medication? Researchers suggest that gait retraining could become an effective intervention for managing knee osteoarthritis, but Dr. Cruz advised that gait retraining is not always straightforward. An individual's gait or walking pattern is influenced by a unique chain of complex musculoskeletal structures. Understanding and examining normal gait patterns can be challenging. Making biomechanical changes to a person's gait pattern can be difficult. So, but understanding what changes are beneficial can be the first hurdle, followed by the challenge of establishing the alteration of gait as the individual's new normal. Additionally, to address the complexities of the process, the analysis and retraining require specialized insight and expensive equipment. Therefore, modifying gait patterns is not a simple process. I don't know. I mean, if you went to a good physical therapist, this could be a simple part of your physical therapy. You don't have to get on a treadmill. You just have you just need to have somebody watch you walk. And if you have a number of physical therapy sessions, which you can get covered by your insurance, one of the things you can do in your physical therapy appointment is gait retraining. And it can be so simple. The person just has to watch you walk and say, all right, a little further out, a little further in, a little further out. No, not that far. Come back in. Perfect. Okay, now walk. And they watch you walk, and then they instruct you, you know. So I don't know why this has to be difficult and expensive. And I betcha if you go onto YouTube, and I haven't looked, but I betcha if you go onto YouTube, because everything is on YouTube, there are probably gait retraining videos on YouTube that people could do. You could also video your PT giving you the instruction, and then you can watch the video while you do your practice walk. So there's recently developed AI technology, because AI technology is all the rage. It allows us to estimate knee loading and determine the best personalized foot angle for each patient. So that's why we're saying, does the person turn out or do they turn in? Well, that has to be determined based on their current gait, the gait that they're doing while they're having the osteoarthritis pain. They want to use the new technology so the gait modification can become widely available in the clinic for patients with knee osteoarthritis. So that's very interesting. So if you have osteoarthritis in your knees, it might be as simple as changing your gait. And if you're concerned about this, it might be worth a trip to the physical therapist to do this. And, you know, you could look at some videos. And you might not want to do it by yourself, because you want to get some instruction, and you want to have somebody watch you walk and watch how you're carrying your feet. So when people come in with knee osteoarthritis, this is something that I will tell them. I might even do a quick scan of their gait and tell them and just give them an idea that just turn out a little, because this is not that hard. I can tell them and give them a little bit of feedback on their gait, because I watch people's gait. When I do physical exams, I check people's gaits, and I what I should be doing during a physical exam is saying, hey, do you have any knee pain? And yes, no. If they do have knee pain, then I'm gonna watch their gait and see if they're turned out or they're turned in, and have them change their gait a little bit. If they're dead on straight, nobody's going to be dead on straight. Most people have a little bit of genu valgus, but genu valgus is when the toes turn in. That's what I have. And genu varus is when they turned out, what you think of as bow-legged. And nobody's perfectly straight ahead. That's unusual. And I'm definitely a genu valgus girl. So Anyway, so if you have osteoarthritis, what I in lieu of, I mean, supplements that I take fish oil, I take collagen. I don't take glucosamine, but you can take glucosamine. Glucosamine chondroitin, MSM. You can also take curcumin and boswellia and rosemary. Those are all herbs with anti-inflammatory properties. And you can take supplements that have a bunch of those things in it. You can get supplements from the drugstore even that have all the, that have a little bit of all those things. Glucosamine, chondroitin, boswellia, turmeric, and turmeric curcumin is extract of turmeric. And rosemary. And there's a common supplement that you can get at the drugstore. People take it and they love it. And they take like two a day and it works. So some people, if they come in and they're taking that supplement, I just ask them, hey, do you think that helps you? They say, yes, keep taking it. Don't get anything from me. Get that. And, you know, get it at freaking Costco or the drugstore or wherever you get it. It's fine. Because I've seen people work it and have it work. The other things that I do for my my osteoarthritis knees, because I'm not ready to have I haven't even had cortisone shots. I'm not in pain. That's the cool thing. I mean, sometimes I'm a little sore, but I did have an episode of knee pain last year that I had to manage. But this year, my knee pain has been okay. It gets a little sore sometimes. I wonder if it's because I'm so careful wearing those bamboo sleeves all the time when I'm exercising, so it keeps things aligned. I also do wall leg lifts, which is a PT exercise where you're strengthening the muscles around the knees. And of course, I ride my bike, which strengthens the muscles around the knees. And I also, I'm not doing them now because of the stenosis, because when I put a lot of load on my left leg, I have more pain. It'll make the nerve flare. So I'm not doing one-legged stances. So I would do one-legged deadlifts, but I'm not doing those right now because of the stenosis. But once my stenosis is corrected, then I will start doing those again. And then also any exercise where you stand on one foot. So if you're standing in line, consider just shifting and standing on one foot for a little bit. If you're doing dishes, you could do it as well. But standing on one foot will help you to strengthen, give you more strength and load on your knees. You can also ice your knees. You can ice them for 15 minutes at a time. So if you ice a knee and say it's night and you're relaxing at home, you can put some ice on your knee, set a timer for 15 minutes, take it off after 15 minutes, wait an hour, and then do it again. And I find, my chiropractor, Dr. Scott, he is just a big fan of ice. And I didn't used to be a big fan of ice, but I think he's right. And the ice is very nice. And when my leg is flared, when my nerve pain is flared, and it's also nice on my knee when it's flared. And then I also use KT tape, or any kind of physical therapy tape. There are ways to do it. You can get that anywhere. You can get it online. You can get it at the drugstore, and you can find YouTubes and also websites that will show you how to apply the tape. And the cool thing about knees is you can apply it yourself. It's very hard to apply tape to your shoulders and your back, because you need two hands, or to your arms or your wrists. You have to have somebody do it. But knees, you can apply yourself. So I have to wrap up. So those were two very interesting articles. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.